That's it. I've had it with this dump. We got no food. We got no jobs. Our pets' heads are falling off.
Hey guys, my name is Suzanne Johnson, and I am with Grace Financial Coaching. I have been guiding my clients in the financial methods of Dave Ramsey for over 5 years now. I partner with motivated individuals, couples, and families, develop good financial habits so they can experience a more stable future and carefree life.
Suzanne, thank you so much for being here today. I appreciate it. I appreciate the time. I guess the first question I'd have is, why are you necessary? Why are we not taught these things? I have my own theories. And why are we so financially illiterate as a society?
Oh my gosh, we talk about money. We talk about sex, religion, and politics more than we talk about money, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Check your latest edition of social media today. And it's really ridiculous. It is something, my understanding of it previously, I actually now have clients in Europe, so I can't even say in America anymore. But my understanding previously was, as Americans, there's just this stigma around money that we can't get over for some reason. We would rather go outside and see our friend pull up in a brand new car and rub the car and look at all the features of the car. And we'll do all of those things, but we will not ask them how much they're paying for that car or how much they paid for that car or what their monthly lease is. So I don't know where that disconnect is, but it obviously exists and it has existed for a long time. And it is my goal to go on podcasts like yours and talk to people about how finances don't have to be so scary, and in the hopes that we can start having this larger conversation and open up the communication about money, specifically our personal finances.
I love it. Yeah, I know within my family, my brothers, we talk openly about it and we talk about all these things. My suspicion is that when you go on social media, you know, those ads that pop up between, I think the powers that be might want to steer us in a direction where we just want to spend. And I think we've gotten stuck in that loop as a society.
Absolutely. We are the most marketed to society. Every society, as we move through the world, right, as we move through time, each society, each generation is now the next most marketed to generation. So yeah, they're just going to keep getting better and better at it. And listen, I don't begrudge anybody, including big companies, the fact that they're making money. I want people to make money. I want people to make money, and I want people to have money, and I want people to be excited about making money. But it's true. We are definitely the most marketed to society. And between that, Amazon, one click, where we just go onto our Amazon apps and we and we just order stuff that we've ordered before. I mean, it's so bad. So yeah, they just make it easier and easier. And that's great that you and your brothers talk about money, for sure. I think it is sometimes a little bit easier with siblings. A lot of what I ask my clients initially when I'm doing their onboarding is, what was money like for you growing up? And it answers a lot. It tells me a lot about what they're currently going through.
Definitely. Yeah, I can definitely see that. And the part of it is, I've listened to you on another podcast, and I agree that I have no problem with spending, and it's nice to get nice things and that sort of thing. But if you can afford it, that's nice. We've gotten to a point where we've gotten to a point where we normalize spending $250,000 on a college education like it's nothing, or spending you name the price on weddings and things like this. And society just tells you that's normal. Like, if you have something against it, you're the crazy one. And it's I'm just not sure how we've gotten to that point.
Yeah, the college thing is out of control. You may have heard me say on one of those other podcasts that the average client that I have now does not have five figures of student debt. They have six figures of student debt. And that's the norm. I get super excited when I have a client who fills out their initial financial snapshot and it's only five figures of student loan debt. So yeah, we have definitely allowed the cost of higher education to get out of control. There is a little pushback now. I mean, we're recording this in 2020, the year of the great pandemic. So I'm starting to see some parents, especially clients that I have who are parents of college students, saying, whoa, why am I paying the in-person tuition? Why am I paying, why did you automatically bill me for a meal plan when the cafeteria is not open? So I think we're getting a little more conscious about it. If anything good comes of this pandemic, let's let it be that we become more conscious about where our money is going.
I have noticed a little bit of that, which has been a good thing that's come out of this so far. We'll see if it lasts. I'm not sure. Right. Once things get back to normal, everything might just get back to normal. You never know.
Absolutely.
When we first spoke, we talked about how it would be great to talk about in kind of going along with my philosophies, the small and incremental changes we can make in our lives to increase our financial standing. And I guess the question is, for the average person, I guess the average American, and I'm not exactly sure overseas how it's going, but the average American has a significant amount of debt. Where should they start with these small changes if they're just trying to keep their heads above water?
I think the first small incremental change we really already spoke about it, is to start to open up communication about your personal financial situation. So let's just use two different examples. We're going to use single and we're going to use married. The married example is easier to explain, but I think it's actually harder to do. So most married couples I have found don't talk about money in depth the way they should. Just so you're aware, when you legally get married, that becomes our money. And I'm not saying that from a religious standpoint or anything like that. I'm just talking straight legality, folks. It is now our money, not your money and my money. It is now our money, even if you haven't combined bank accounts. So being able to bring up the topic of money is hard, and putting yourselves in situations where you force yourself to talk about it, doing that incrementally over time makes it a more comfortable conversation when you start to get to the big stuff.
Sure. Definitely. Yeah. That's very helpful. And for those people who have not combined accounts when they do get married, is there benefits? What do you suggest when you are talking to couples who are either married but have not yet combined finances or about to get married? What is your suggestion to them?
Yeah, I am a big fan of combining money. I will tell you a little bit of my personal story. I am previously divorced and I have since remarried. And in my first marriage, we did not combine finances. And I think that was, while it wasn't the ultimate reason why the marriage didn't last, it definitely contributed to the psychological aspect of we're still two people. We're two different people, not two people who are married. We kept that psychological level of we are two different people, and having the money separate feeds into that. So I'm a big proponent of combining everything. Now, the one thing I will say, there's a little bit of a caveat. In the budgets that I do with my clients, we specifically have a category for fun money. And when I'm working with a married couple, we have her money and his money, or her money and her money, or however the couple is laid out, each person has their own money. So sometimes I will say, yes, keep your own personal bank account. And then every single month we do an auto transfer of $100 a month to that personal bank account, or $100 a month, or $200 a month, or whatever it is. And then they can spend that money freely. And the whole point of the fun money is so that it doesn't cause arguments. So if your husband walks in with a new TV after 8 months of saving fun money, or the wife walks in with 20 shopping bags, no one's allowed to say anything because it came out of the fun money. So that alleviates a lot of the stress on the relationship.
Yeah.
But other than that, savings, checking, the checking account where the bills come out, credit cards, if you still have them. Yes, I think that everything should be combined.
Okay. And you say credit cards, if you still have them. If I could live without a credit card, I would, but it seems like just to build your credit, you're incentivized to have this, you know, larger line of credit, to have more open accounts, to everything is geared towards debt. How do you balance that with, a good credit score, with, you know, actual good practices with your finances?
Yeah. And this was actually another one of the incremental changes I was going to mention. Getting off the credit cards, yes, unfortunately in society, the way that our FICO scores and our credit scores are calculated, those are not your really good at money scores.
No.
Those are, you're really good at debt scores.
Exactly. Yep.
And so a lot of people don't understand that. If you get into a position where you're like, you know what, I'm done with the credit cards, I'm done with the debt, I want to pay everything down. By paying off the debt initially, that's actually going to make your score go up. Mm-hmm. Because what the creditors are looking at are, oh, look, they're paying this down. Maybe they made, they got a raise and they're putting more money towards it. Great. All right, let's increase their score a tiny bit over a period of time. When I started paying my $90,000 down, my credit score went through the roof.
Exactly.
But the problem is, over time, what they want to see is a revolving door of debt. They want to see you go in and out, in and out. They want you to have this long-term relationship with debt. So we would prefer, most financial coaches are going to try to limit that situation. So here's a way to incrementally get yourself off credit cards, but still have that credit score that society wants us to have. I have my clients keep the credit cards that are the most beneficial. So if they travel, if they live, for example, I lived in San Diego for 5 years and I'm originally from New York. So I was going back and forth a lot. It's a lot of airline miles.
Yeah.
If they have an airline miles card that they want to keep up, we stop using the credit card for stuff that we actually can't afford. And we move over the bills that we're paying anyway. So move over the cell phone bill, pay it off with the credit card, and set up an auto transfer every single month for $157.15 for your Verizon wireless bill, and then just pay it off. The credit score companies don't know what you're using the card for. They just see revolving activity that is growing and then shrinking and growing and then shrinking and getting paid off on time and then growing and then shrinking. So that's definitely a change you can make. You can put the bills on that you pay monthly anyway and then pay off the card immediately. And that's going to keep your credit score pretty close to 800.
Yeah, sure. I know I have a travel card that I'm obviously not using for travel at the moment. So I think I just have my, all that's on there is my Hulu account. I move the Hulu on there, auto pay it every month just so that it's open. There's something on it and keeps a good balance. But it's a shame that we have to, you know, use these tricks and tips and not just practice good financial practices, but it's just the way it is in society.
The ideal situation would be no debt, your credit score actually, it will go down and then it actually disappears. You'll get an error saying that you don't have a credit score.
Yeah.
And then you have a millions of dollars in the bank and you pay cash for everything.
Exactly.
But so, depending on where you are in the situation in your process, how old you are, it may not be possible. But as a financial coach, that's what I do. I try to get people to make these small changes in their habits and their in their thinking so that they can have a good life from whatever point they a good, better financial life from whatever point they are now moving forward.
Yeah, exactly. Now, do you have a specific? I know there's so many budgets out there and ways to budget. Do you have a specific way that you tell people to budget? Like I know we've used like an envelope budget in the past and things like that. I'm sure you're familiar with all of them. Do you have a favorite budget that you use?
Yes. So I am a Ramsey preferred coach, Dave Ramsey, and they came out with an app in April of 2015. And if I was the first person to download that app, I wouldn't have been surprised. I started my debt-free journey in 2014. So this was several months later and I downloaded it. And at the time, I think maybe it cost like $100 to connect your bank. It's obviously grown in popularity. It's a little more than that on an annual basis. I think the last time I got charged, it was like $130. It's called Every Dollar. And if you pay for Every Dollar Plus, which is the feature that tells you that connects the banks, mm-hmm. your transactions and a lot of other budgeting apps do this, but this one I found to be the most convenient. And listen, guys, no one really wants to do all this fun stuff with money, right? The only people who like doing this stuff is me.
I'm with you. So I like doing it too.
If you can get an app that's going to do all this work for you and you're going to wake up on Monday morning, Tuesday morning for the weekend and say, oh, look, I have 10 transactions from the weekend. Drag and drag and drag into the correct budget categories. I'm done. Oh my gosh. Like it was a game changer for me. So I will never, and honestly, I'm completely out of debt. My husband's completely out of debt. We have no debt on anything right now except our mortgage. we use that app religiously on a daily basis because we've created that little habit and we're carrying it forward.
Yeah, I always get fed up. I always go back to the budgeting apps, but they automatically categorize and put it in the wrong things. I got to dig in and change them up. So I always set a budget on there, then get fed up and stop. And next thing you know, there's no budget again.
I've heard that about the other main platforms, other budgeting platforms. This one you have to drag and drop. The only thing that it will self-categorize after it learns, because it is a learning app, is the income. But every expense you have to go through, and there's psychology around that. We should be looking at what we're spending on a daily basis, no matter how big or small. So it kind of forces you to look. It does force you to look at all the expenses. After a few months, it'll automatically move your income to the proper categories.
Okay. And are there any rules of thumb as to how much should go towards housing, how much towards food, how much towards entertainment? Do you have any, without giving away everything that you do for your clients?
Oh, that's fine. Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you have any rules of thumb for that?
I do. There's a whole, if you go into that app, they will actually show you the different percentages of what it's supposed to be. So I think one of the ones that I always talk with people about is housing, especially in the area where I grew up. I went to school in Fairfield County, Connecticut, another very expensive area of the country. And then I was bored after a while and I moved to San Diego, another very expensive area of the country. Yeah. I'm not allowed to live anywhere cheap. So one of the things that people always get on Dave, if you've ever listened to his radio show, is you can't have your housing expenses in more expensive areas of the country get under 25%. And that's what Dave recommends, is 25% approximately for housing costs, maybe 30. You will get people who call his show from LA and say, Dave, that's just not humanly possible. And he does. He draws a line in the sand and says, well, you can make certain changes and you can lower it. But, you know, the cost of a house in Tennessee is just never going to be the same as the cost of a house in New York City. Right. So that category specifically, I will work with people and I'll say, listen, guys, you know, Dave says housing shouldn't be more than 25%. You're pushing 50% of your housing costs in your monthly budget. That's not sustainable for anybody, no matter how many millions of dollars they're making, because the cost of their house is now 50% of their, and that's a lot. So yeah, so there's definitely percentages that you can use as guidelines, but you have to take everything with a grain of salt, obviously. So that's, again, another thing that I work with clients on, is to specify a plan for them and say, okay, listen, you live in LA, you live in San Diego, you live in Philadelphia, you live wherever, it's just too expensive. It's not going to fall under 25%, but maybe we need to get it down from 50 or 40.
Yeah, my wife and I moved back to New Jersey last year from Silicon Valley, and good luck getting it under 25% there. It is a struggle. I don't know how people do it. And I think you're seeing a lot of people make mass exodus out of New York and LA and San Jose and all these places for that reason. It's not sustainable. You can't do it. People need to live.
Right. And now, you know, we're talking about all this in the midst of the pandemic. And if people continue to work remotely from home, that exodus from those cities is just going to continue getting greater and greater.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a boom in the small towns, small suburban towns, from people just being able to work from home and having that small town feel with a reasonable rent again, or even considering buying a house for the first time.
Yeah, definitely. I have a friend who just put up on social media yesterday that this is her last week in New York City, and she works for a major PR firm that's been in Manhattan for 50 something years.
Yeah.
And she's going to some small town in Western Pennsylvania that I can't pronounce. So that really, you know, there's people like that out there. And one of those motivating factors is money and the cost of housing.
Oh yeah, definitely. And then another question I'd have is, okay, say you're fortunate enough to get out of debt, and then you buy a house, you have some excess money coming in. What do you start to do? How do you start allocating that excess capital? How do you say you've gotten out of debt, now you want to start building your road to becoming a millionaire? What do you suggest as a good starting place, say, for investing? And how much do you keep in cash? Do you pay a little extra towards your mortgage every month? And these are all personal questions.
This is actually not a podcast recording. This is actually Michael's first his first coaching session. So, okay, exactly. Let's talk about that. Yeah, so we want to make sure consumer debt is paid off first. So you made a great distinction there by saying paying off debt while still paying on a mortgage. So that's the, we want to get out of this consumer debt, man. I mean, I don't see personal loans below 9% anymore. I don't see, I mean, you see the promotional credit cards, which are designed to prey on your psychology. Reel you in and then keep you. And I've got a client who's got two of those expiring, and one of them is jumping up to 23.99%. Stop giving your money away to people who don't deserve it.
Yes.
So pay off the consumer debt. That's what we're saying. And student loans still fall into that, even if the interest rate is 2%. So we want to pay off the consumer debt. So let's assume we paid off all the consumer debt. We finally paid off Sally Mae or Navient or however, depending on how old you are. Mindset's Sally Mae on it, that probably tells you something. Then we want to look at building our emergency fund. So let's assume you guys are in a great position, you've paid off the debt, and you have an emergency fund to the point where if something happened, a tree goes through the roof, and you've got a $5,000 deductible on your house, you're not going to have to tap into retirement to get to that $5,000. So that's the kind of stuff, you know, if somebody breaks their arm, the transmission falls out of the car. That's the kind of big stuff we have emergency funds for. We don't want to touch retirement for that kind of stuff. So we have that saved up. We've paid off our consumer debt. We've got a mortgage. And now we're like, okay, what do? We have $350 a month we want to be putting away into something. So we actually have a goal of 15% into retirement.
Okay.
And that's after, that is when we calculate that 15%. Use your income that you get into your paycheck. So 15% of what is deposited into your account on a monthly basis.
So that's your actual 401k retirement?
So that's the number we want to be putting aside. So if you make, you know, $10,000 a month, we're doing 15% of that is going into retirement savings. And then let's backtrack into what kind of retirement savings. So we have that number in our heads. First, we want to look at our 401k plans. 401k, 403b if you're a municipal employee or a teacher, TSP if you're military. Those are going to be most likely the best tax sheltered plans to fund fully first.
Yeah. Okay.
Always try to do the Roth IRA, the Roth 401k. Not everybody has a Roth 401k. If you have one, do the Roth 401k, the Roth 403b, et cetera, et cetera. We just moved all of my husband's TSP contributions. He's active duty military into the, they have a Roth TSP now. They didn't have this up until about a year or two ago.
Okay.
So we're going to look at those first. See what the match is. Get up to the match. If your company's doing a 3% match, the best I've heard of recently is 6%. That was super high. So if you know your company has a 3% match, match it at the 3%. Figure out what that is coming out of your paycheck in dollar amounts. And subtract it from that 15% number that we started off with.
Okay.
So now we're backing into that 15% of your income number. So let's do the 401k plans first. Then we would do an IRA situation, most likely a Roth IRA. If you make over 129, you don't qualify. 129,000, you don't qualify for a Roth. I think that's the new number this year. So then we would go to from a 401k to an IRA. So those are our two biggest vehicles when we're first starting off to invest for retirement.
Okay.
And then anything outside beyond that, if you are already maxing out to the match of your 401k, you're maxing out a Roth IRA, which I believe is $6,500 a person this year, more if you're over the age, if you're above catch-up age, then we would go back to the 401k and we'd kind of fill in the blank. That's kind of the methodology for getting to that 15%.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay,
and
cool.
And then I guess to settle some family debates, how much Bitcoin should I be buying and how much gold and silver should I be burying in my backyard?
So I was a little afraid you were going to ask me about the day trading thing that has certainly gone global to the point where my sister has been listening to a little too many Barstool podcasts and invested in Tesla this summer and made money. That luckily she's in a position where she has money to mess around with.
Yeah.
So to touch on that briefly, Bitcoin, day trading, that's, those are hobbies, guys, when it comes to your financial plan.
So the way I say it is only put in as much as you're willing to lose
That is literally the money you put aside to go to Atlantic City or Vegas. That is not part of your strategic financial plan.
Oh boy, I might be in trouble.
So if you are messing around with, if you have the extra income, you're out of debt, and you're literally like, okay, I'm going to budget $300 a month and I'm going to mess around and see what I can do with it. Dude, knock yourself out all day long. I got clients who spend way more than $300 a month on a hobby. That's for sure.
Sure, absolutely.
But then to go back to answer your question about gold, I actually do take this very seriously because, this isn't like, you know, end of the world type cinematic movie stuff, but, you know, I don't think that this is going to happen in the next handful of years, maybe in the next 100 years. But if we ever get to a point in our global economy where global banks start crashing, yes, there is a genuine fear people have and they want to see their dollars in little pieces of gold. I totally understand that. I would not bury it in the backyard. Don't do that. I would keep it in a fireproof safe somewhere and have multiple copies of the key.
Sure.
Or even, you know, if you still trust the American banking system, go put it in a safety deposit box. But yeah, I deal with people with this a lot. And with all the unrest that's going on right now, you know, from a war standpoint, we're looking pretty good right now. We're not getting into any major conflicts. If we get into a World War III situation, I could totally see people wanting to have more of their dollars and cents and really, we barely touch money anymore, right?
Yeah.
It's all on our phones. It's all like in the little plastic card you're holding. I can totally understand why some people are like, this doesn't feel very secure for me. So if you want to have some money above and beyond your emergency fund in precious metals, again, it should not be 100% of your emergency fund. You can't go to the mechanic shop and hand them a brick of gold and say, fix my car.
Not yet, anyway.
Not right now. We don't work like that right now. That's what I was going to say. So it could be part of your saving strategy. But again, we should not be contributing to our 401k so that we can buy another gold bar. That money is still going to grow compound interest, even if everything crashes, you know, eventually one day.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And it's pretty much along the lines of what we talk about. So if things ever take off in Bitcoin, yeah, great. But don't put in any more than you're willing to lose. And as far as investing, how much do you do any personal investing on the side? Everyone these days has a Robinhood account if you're new to investing, and it seems to be taking off. Do you consider that the same thing? Don't put anything in you're not willing to lose?
Yes, for sure. I actually have a client right now who started doing Robinhood in like January. And she's like, but look how much I'm up. And I'm like, I get it. I'm like, I don't know what it's going to look like on November 4th, the day after Election Day.
So exactly.
I'm holding my breath.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is, again, if you're making money off of that, and like, let's just use a real life example. Let's say you're putting $150 a budget a month, that's not unreasonable, towards playing around in the stock market, towards day trading, towards Robinhood. And you wake up one morning and for some reason your investments have like, you know, doubled or you've made 10 times your money overnight. Man, I mean, take it out and put it in your emergency fund. It's not like you're not allowed to save that money.
Yeah.
But again, it's just not part of, or listen, if that wants to be your gambling money, and you want to go on vacation with that money, yeah, great. You know, I might also be saving up a sinking fund for vacation over here, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, use it. I mean, for sure. I mean, if you're making money off that stuff, I am not begrudging anybody making money off that stuff. I just don't want it to be 50, 40, 30% of your long-term financial plan.
Yeah. And I think it's good to know if anything seems too good to be true, as we know, it probably is too good to be true. And I think I personally think we're seeing a little bit of that in the stock market right now. There's debates on either side, but it's a little bit wild right now.
Yeah, my favorite phrase of the summer has got to be stocks only go up.
Yeah. It seems that way at the moment, but we know it's not the truth.
Yeah, Davy Day Trader Global might need a financial coach in the near future.
Exactly. So I guess we're just at about at the end of our podcast. I'd love to have you back on if that's okay. I have thousands of questions. I could have you on for hours. if you could give someone, so I always like to say I'm sending this podcast out to people who are like me at every stage of my life. If you're someone who's young, say you're 18 and you're just starting your financial journey, what are a couple of the tips that you would say are the most important to consider moving forward?
Understand that personal finance, the personal part of personal finance, is 80% your fault. It is 80% your behavior. When we talk about personal finance, we only look at the numbers as 20% of the equation. So I don't care if you're in $5,000 of debt or $500,000 worth of debt. 80% of whatever goal you have needs to come from you changing on a behavioral basis. And one of the things I encourage people to ask themselves, and this is just a question you can have in the back of your mind, look at what you're about to spend money on at any stage of your life. Like you just said, at 18-year-old Michael, at 25-year-old Michael, at 85-year-old Michael. Look at what you're doing, what you're about to spend money on, and ask yourself, does this support the kind of life I'm trying to create? Because if you get that question and you're at the back of your mind, does this support the kind of life I'm trying to create? Then going to Starbucks, stopping the habit of going to Starbucks every day, of going to Dunkin' Donuts, obviously we grew up in the Northeast,
yeah,
is going to be easier when you say, okay, no, I don't, I can make coffee at home. I'd much rather have $150 a month to try to put into a Roth IRA. This doesn't support the kind of life I'm trying to create. So as having that in the back of your head, put it on a sticky note in your car or on the back of your cell phone or something. and ask yourself that question when you're about to spend money, no matter how big or how small, is this going to help me down the road? Because the sooner you start to look at your the things that you're doing as opportunity costs or missed opportunities, then you're going to be much better off with your money, because it is 80% behavior and only 20% math.
That is a great unmotivated habit to get into, the habit of asking yourself that and having in the back of your mind all the time. I love it. That's going to be my key takeaway, I think, from this. That's a really great piece of advice.
Awesome.
And Suzanne, where can everyone find you? Where can they sign up to get your coaching, and what are your socials? What's all that?
Yeah. So I'm at Grace Financial Coach on Instagram. And then you guys can find me on my website. It's gracefinancialcoaching.com, G-R-A-C-E. And right on the front there, if your listeners mention that they heard me on your podcast and they want to sign up for what we call a strategy session, it's a completely free call. We spend a full 40 minutes going over your finances and your particular situation. I will be sending your listeners a free book. They can choose which one they would like to get.
Awesome. I'll put all the links in the profile for this episode, and I appreciate it. And thank you for my free session.
Yes. And if I come back, I guess it'll be another free session.
Absolutely. Suzanne, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And hopefully I'll talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.